RunAsRadio.com. You're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell and Greg Hughes. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 100 with guest Greg Hughes, recorded Tuesday, February 17th, 2008. Run As Radio is produced each week by Pwop Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow the guys on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Hey, you're listening to Run As Radio. I'm your host, Richard Campbell. With me, as always, my co-host, Greg Hughes.
As always, show number 100.
Dude, obviously we're not learning.
Been doing this for quite a while, almost 2 years now. When is our anniversary? Is it April?
It's in April, yeah.
All right, so this is show 100, and then we have our 2-year anniversary also coming up.
Something like that, yeah. Well, the show's published in March, so it all makes sense. The math, if you work it out, it does make sense. But yeah, we recorded our first show, or published our first show, back on April 11th, 2007. Good old Pat Hines.
That was my birthday. No, not dropping hints or anything there, but no worries.
There you go. Congratulations, sir. 100 shows.
Yeah, congratulations to you. It's been pretty fun, hasn't it?
It absolutely has been fun. I think, we just dropped right into this. And I was feeling around for what we should really do for 100th show. I thought it would be fun just to interview you. Because lots of folks ask where the heck we came from and, you know, who are we and what are we doing? And and I know a bit about your history, but I thought it might be more fun to have folks actually hear the story. You've been in IT a long time.
Yeah. Well, if you're sure that's what you want to do, we could do that. That'll work. I think, you know, everybody always considers their own story to be kind of, you know, well, so what?
You're too busy living it to bother to tell it, right?
Sure. I know I've certainly heard you tell stories many, many times over and over again over the years. And you tell great stories. You're the master storyteller.
Well, yeah, that's just a lifestyle thing for me. My line is always, I would never let the truth get in the way of a good story.
There you go.
But I don't want to jump all the way to the part where we met, because that was quite late in the game. But you did not start out in technology.
Oh, no, not at all. Well, I don't know. I guess it depends on how you look at it. Professionally, career-wise, I definitely did not start out in technology. I started out in photojournalism.
Something went terribly wrong there.
Yeah, well, you know, it was a lot of fun. It was something I think I was actually pretty darn good at. I really enjoyed it. It just didn't pay the bills all that well.
Right.
So, you know, we can cover the detailed history, but I mean, photojournalism first. I was a police officer second. And then, this is career-wise speaking, and then after that, started to get into the internet side of IT, web development, and then, you know, the data center side, and then working my way, from there. But really, the people ask me, where did you go to school? I've never had any formal training in IT. It's all been, osmosis, self-taught, OJT type stuff.
Right.
But what I did have, the only formal training I've had in computers actually was before the photojournalism phase, was way back when I was a kid. I grew up in Los Alamos, New Mexico, which is the Los Alamos National Laboratory is there.
That's where the original atomic bomb was let off.
Right. Well, that's where it was built, right? That's where it was designed and created, and then they drove it or snuck it or did whatever they do south down toward to White Sands down south in New Mexico. And that's where they blew it up, right? So, but you're right. The atomic bombs that were dropped at the end of World War II, they were built there in Los Alamos. And so there's a nuclear weapons laboratory there. And also, they also do a lot of health sciences and medical type stuff there. And, my dad is a PhD in physics and a brilliant guy. And he was working there. My mom was a nurse at the laboratory there, but that's where I grew up. Me and my brother and my mom and dad. And so, it's a small town. It was about 18,000 people at the time. I think it's probably about the same size now. You know, we had one high school.
Right.
Everybody knew everybody. It was a very high pressure town, and it still is, I think.
Just because it's a huge collection of super smart people.
It is. It's actually, I'm told, and I believe it is, I think this is accurate, it's the highest per capita PhD population in the world.
And if that doesn't make you feel dumb, I don't know what will.
Yeah, well, and try being the kids of the highest per capita PhD population.
Yeah, no kidding.
And if you can imagine the, you know, those people have all gone through lots and lots of college and the pressure, you, not always unreasonable, sometimes unreasonable to be honest, but the pressure to succeed and to excel was pretty high.
Sure.
One of the things though that was really, really cool about growing up there was not only is it a beautiful place, an amazing place, and it's like 7,500 feet above sea level, so you're automatically, you know, training to be like an Olympic athlete, I guess.
Yeah.
But we have, we had a lot of computers around, a lot of technology stuff. One of my favorite, technology memories as a kid was when my dad brought home, a laser and, brought it inside the house at night. And, he lit a match and put smoke in the air, and he was doing laser physics at the time. And he shined the laser across the room, and the smoke was going through it, and you could see the laser beam in the air. And he taught me, he explained to me, like, from beginning to end, everything about how a laser works in a way that was completely easy to understand, right?
Cool.
And that was really, really cool. It was one of the cool things that I just remember from being a kid. But the other thing that we had was, you know, there was a buddy of mine, Mark. And, he lived, we lived in, it was kind of a ruralish sort of area. It's, when I think rural, I think trees and stuff like that. And
right.
This was the desert. This was the desert. So it was
so it's cactus.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Well, you know, there's, well, yeah, there was trees, but you know, they're not the same kind of trees. Not that we have here in the Pacific Northwest. That's for sure. But Mark's dad had the first ever that I ever saw and one of the very first Apple computers that wasn't the one that was in a wood box. So, not the original Apple that they built, but it would have been Apple II, the very first one.
Right.
And I remember he had the cassette tape thing that he added on and you know, the floppy drive in there that they added on and then a second floppy drive, I think. And that was really cool. And you might remember the name. I can never remember the name of the magazine, but there was like a Mac magazine. Well, an app, it wasn't even Mac then, was it? It was Apple. There was an Apple magazine that would come and it was on newsprint and you would open it up and it would have inside line after line after line after line of Apple Basic.
Yeah. Yeah. No, there was a bunch of magazines like that way back then. There was actually a magazine called the Apple Magazine.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So you remember details and I don't. So this is how we complement each other. This is part of why we work well together.
I think so.
But he, his dad and they would get that magazine and we would sit there all summer long and wait for that magazine. And when it would come, we would start typing for days and start typing line after line, hundreds and hundreds and thousands of lines of basic code in and just to see what it would do. And it might be one of those text games, you know, you are standing in a field. Great.
Yeah.
You know, the Zork style thing. But I remember very clearly when we typed in, a program and it started to draw lines on the screen and we could tweak the program. I remember going in, we figured it out how the whole coordinate system worked and all that. And this was, I mean, it's not like there was classes to learn this stuff, right? I mean, this was like the computer showed up. It was sitting in the living room and we would sit there and just figure things out, but how to draw lines from here to there and how to actually create images on the screen and how to change the program so that, you know, instead of saying, you know, saying something like you're standing in a field, it said you're standing in a freaking field or whatever, right? So little stuff, but and by today's standards, really easy to do. But for kids that were sitting there and looking at computer programming language for the first time and really having hardly anybody there, we didn't ask anybody questions. We just looked at it and figured it out. And I didn't plan at that point in time that I would ever have anything to do with computers. I just thought it was fun.
Right.
You know, we also had a lot of fun doing things like go-karts and, you know, building model rockets, soaking them in gasoline and shooting them at each other. So we did all kinds of crazy stuff. But ultimately, I think that time plus my – In high school, before I finished high school, I had taken Pascal, Fortran, done some assembly, and worked with a bunch of different computers in high school. So we were really lucky to have that. That's my really long explanation of how cool it was to grow up and all the things that we were lucky to have in Los Alamos.
Sure, absolutely.
And those certainly influenced me later on in life.
So, but you did eventually end up in a career in IT somehow. I'm still trying to get there, trying to get to us meeting.
Right. So, well, that's okay. Well, we'll get there.
Yeah.
So, So as I said, you know, I did the photojournalism thing, and you know, there was computer flavor to everything I did. We networked computers together at the college to have the PCs talk to each other and the Macs talk to each other, and then eventually figured out and jerry-rigged some ways to make the Macs and the PCs talk to each other.
Right.
That was cool. That was the very first Macintoshes there, you know, those little doorstop bricks. And then in police work, you know, I was just involved with on the periphery projects, just helping out with little things like, you know, wiring up, they put CDPD modems in the trunks of the police cars.
Right. Of course, you just got to remind everyone, it's at one point you were a cop.
Yeah. I was a cop for, 7 years. There's this magical 7 or 8 year thing where I was, you know, photojournalism for about 7 or 8 years. I was a cop for 7 or 8 years. Anyway,
this has got more to do with your short attention span than anything else, I think.
Yeah, or short something. I don't know. So it's a tolerance or what do you? I don't know what it is. But so we did all kinds of cool things throughout those careers, and the police work thing was fun. And you know, in police work, you know, there was the whole concept of investigations and forensics and
right.
just general catching bad guys, kind of stuff that was always something that I'd always wanted to do. You know, there were police officers when I was growing up that I really looked up to as role models, and I'm sure that influenced my decision to eventually decide to actually stop. You know, sometimes I say, you know, I used to chase ambulances and police cars, and I decided to go and drive them. and I can tell you that it is an awful lot of fun to drive police cars at certain times. So, and it's pretty exciting actually. But ultimately, this was in the early 90s when I became a cop, I guess it's about 1992, or a police officer, I should say. From there, there was a lot of technology, involvement and again, I was just on the periphery of the projects for, you know, putting laptops in the cellular data modems that they were, this is like analog. This is like 19.2, right?
Right.
19,200 baud, low speed modems, hot, fast at the time. But sticking them in the trunks of police cars with radios, that we were communicating electronically on laptop computers. With our dispatch center, and with each other from car to car, which is really cool. In fact, if you were lucky and, you know, on the inside there, you could even, load web pages, some of the early web pages that were available in the early to mid 90s.
Wow.
On the laptop. It was, you know, slower and snot, but you could do it. But we, did a lot of cool technology stuff at that department. There was a guy, Dan Darnell, who was really involved in pushing technology there, and it made a big difference. But the internet was becoming a really popular thing, right, at the time.
Sure.
It was on the big upswing, and you know, in the 1995-ish time frame, you know, an ISP opened up in Farmington, New Mexico, you know, in the Four Corners area, which is pretty much in the middle of nowhere. It's a shopping city in the middle of nowhere there. Which is where I was working in law enforcement. I opened up an internet account, and of course I had a computer at home, and hooked it up to the internet, and started building web pages. And that's really how I actually, that was my first real move that directly got me into IT. I started doing web pages, was noticed by the guy that owned the ISP. He asked me if I would mind doing some work for him on the side to do some web development and building websites. And I started doing that, got involved with a startup business. And from there ended up getting involved with a large regional airline, that was based out of Farmington and then moved to Phoenix and went on as a contractor doing their webmaster. And really it just went from there. I ended up moving to Oregon, took a job, as a webmaster at a chip maker. And very quickly after that was, stolen away and hired by Carillion, which the company doesn't exist now. It was acquired by another company called CheckFree. And at Carillion, I was there from 1999 until late 2007.
Right.
And progressed through several different positions and areas of responsibility while I was there. But that included started there as the webmaster and then applications management for computer applications, and then ended up IT manager and IT director, and then the VP of IT, which is sort of the CIO type of role there,
right?
And the chief security executive, and working for and with a really great guy who right now is working over in London. His name is Jim Maloney, and he was the chief security executive prior to me, and learned a lot from him. So he was definitely one of my strong mentors there. And one of the things that we did there was in IT and in security was implementing standards.
And this is around the time that I got to know you. Was you really serious about security, like in a very deep way?
Well, we were, but so Corellian was an online, and you know, still is in its, you know, it's owned and part of a bigger company now, but it was an online banking company. And right. So, you know, at the time, about a third of the online banking transactions in the United States were going through being processed by or in some way managed by Corellian's software. And that's a lot.
That is a lot of transactions.
That's a whole lot of transactions, millions and millions of transactions a day, you know, in the tens of millions. And so, you know, the responsibility associated with building that software, running it in a proper way, developing standards under which it should be run, and, you know, the proper way to manage and do the care and feeding of it. It was just really critical. On top of that, we ran, you know, 12, 13, 15, don't know the exact number, it was around 15 different banks in our data centers. So we ran their online banking infrastructure for them. And then connected via private connections back to their host, right, to their mainframe, you know, back at the bank. So, you know, provided the option, you know, and so from an infrastructure standpoint and a 24/7 operations standpoint, we were responsible for managing the security 24/7 of those online banking sites. And that, you know, that's a pretty big deal.
Sure.
So, you know, I think we hear a lot these days, you know, people saying, There's a major argument in the industry or the security industry about is security a cost center or should it be positioned as a business enabler, right? And I argue the latter. And there's a lot of people who say that that's just crap and we can't make that argument and it's a bad argument because it's something that we have to do and that's just the way it is and it costs money and it never makes money. Well, that's just not true. I can tell you that, you know, in our experience, you know, we certified under what was the British standard 7799 or BS7799. So it's the ISO 17799.
Right. But it's specific for the British standard, but the equivalent of an ISO certification.
Which at the time was the international standard. And the ISO certification came along afterwards that was based on 17799. And that's ISO 27001, which actually adopted the British standard, extended it somewhat and modified it a little bit just to make it a little more, comprehensive. And a little more specific in a couple of areas. And we certified under that standard. And so, you know, from the standpoint of being, you know, the online banking company that's driving probably the, you know, a massive percentage of online banking transactions and working with, you know, 8 of the top 10 financial institutions and 20 some odd of the top 100, you know, we had to do that well. And so having, you know, the thing about the ISO 27001 standard is we were able to be tested against that. And I'm not saying this because to tell the story of all the different things I've done. I think that this stuff is important, right? You know, we did things well, and the way that we knew we did things well is that we opened the doors and left them open and had evaluators, you know, examiners coming in all the time on a continuous basis and taking a look at the way we do things and telling us with, you know, in very blunt form, how we were doing and what we needed to do differently.
Right.
And as a result, because we did that, you know, we did a pretty darn good job. We really did.
I'm still wrestling with this idea that security as an asset, isn't it? It still seems like a requirement to me.
Well, can't it be a requirement and be an asset?
Well, I'm with you. I'm just trying to see, you know, what the value proposition is here. I mean, admittedly, there are some sales you're not going to be able to make. It's a facilitator to sale, but is it actually going to create that sale?
Well, and in our case, the vast majority of sales were not that way. And what we've seen over the last few years, is that if you cannot show that you have a comprehensive security program in place in the financial services marketplace, you don't get to play.
You're out. So it is totally a requirement. You've got to have this stuff. And there are really degrees of, you know, how good are you?
Sure. But at the same time, you know, I mean, I was working in the media and, you know, sort of a go-to person. We were looked to as a thought leadership group. And I was quite often, you know, interviewed to provide, you know, views and points of view and opinions related to what's going on in the marketplace with the media at the time. And that meant more exposure for our company as sort of a side effect. And so, you know, there was really a lot of business advantage. And our whole idea was that, in a competitive marketplace was that our security program, if we did it really, really well, would be a competitive advantage. And we found that it was.
Well, and okay, I'll buy that. It was a competitive advantage that because you really got to the point of having marquee security. Like, this is the benchmark that others are measured by.
Yeah,
I guess that's got to be specific to an industry. The banks care that much. It's actually going to influence a decision of purchase.
Yeah. And I mean, me personally, I wouldn't say that we were the measure the benchmark that others were measured by. I would say that we were a benchmark at times that others were measured by. And certainly that we were a benchmark that we ourselves were measured by.
Right.
And I know that sounds a little flat, but seriously, that really is the way it works. But also from an IT standpoint, you know, I mean, if you do IT really, really well and you partner with other companies, I really believe in hiring the best people and then giving them whatever they need to be able to do their job well.
Sure.
And then getting the hell out of the way, right? Be there for them, support them, and continue to make sure that, you know, that you have a good process that works really well. Be a part of that process, but don't be the impediment to getting the job done. In fact, I think a professional manager's job is to be the filter, if you will, right?
Right.
Protect those people from the distractions. And I'm not saying protect them from intentional bad guys, but protect them from the distractions that keep them from being effective. From whether it was a security standpoint or an IT standpoint or a whole variety of other directions, that our business went in at Carillion, we were quite often looked to by our partners and customers and other companies as a place to go, for help when things were difficult.
Okay. I mean, it makes sense, but I find that as positive as you want to be, people see security as an obstacle for the most part.
The difficulty is, so it's the protect and serve thing, right? So now we're going to go back to the police story. So, the fact of the matter is that in security and in IT and different organizations sometimes have those things mixed together or completely separate or sort of a hybrid, but you have to be, from a control standpoint, from a budget standpoint on IT especially, and from a process standpoint, you're quite often the person that has to say no.
Right.
The problem in IT and security, the cliche problem, and I'm going to say something bad about my compadres in these fields, right, is that people think that that's what they are supposed to do, is say no.
Right.
And that, guys, gals, that is not what you're supposed to do. What you are supposed to be doing is finding a way to say yes. That may not mean that you are saying yes to exactly what they're requesting, but ultimately, when somebody is coming to you and presenting you with their solution for how to solve the problem for the business thing that they need to get done, right? What they really, really are asking for, or what they really need, even if they don't necessarily cognitively know it, is they need to try to find a way to meet their business need. Now, I mean, those of us in IT and security, but especially in IT, know that quite often people will come to us and they will have a solution in mind. It's the most harebrained scheme that we've ever heard of, right? And we roll our eyes and we cuss behind their backs and we talk about them in bad ways. And that's too bad, but it does happen, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
But ultimately, what that means is that we're not training our customers very well. These are our customers. And if they're coming to us and they feel like they have to put together and go out and get quotes and bids for servers, and they have to bring all of this stuff in, and they have to have the whole thing designed before IT ever sees it. And then, of course, it's frustrating when they bring it to us and we're saying, well, that doesn't fit into our infrastructure. That won't work. And there's all these holes in your theory and your design is not going to work. And ultimately, if we were out in front and proactively helping them solve their problems and providing that service, then we wouldn't have to say no nearly as often when, you know, at the time that they actually come to us, which is way, way too late.
Yeah, generally they come to you at the end when their app doesn't work, right? Because your security rules have actually done their job and blocked whatever it is they thought they could do.
Right. And this is why it's so important to attack these problems in the design phase way, way, way before anything ever gets built, right? You know, I really believe that, so touching on the security side of things, security is a key component of quality. I don't think you can run a business or build a product or an application or write software in a way that is quality sufficient without having security be an underlying component of all of it.
Right.
And it's not just security. There's other components of quality as well. So, but security, there's a tendency. And this is fed, I want to point this out, by security people who say no a lot and who are the throw down the gauntlet and get emotional and challenge people a lot. That style, that FUD, fear, uncertainty, and doubt style of security that ruins business.
Yeah.
That is harmful to the point where people won't involve security. They look at security as these necessary brick walls that they have to walk up to at some point before they finish this project. And you hear it all the time. We need security to sign off on this.
Right. I don't actually want them involved. I just want them to agree and go away.
Right. We need you to do a review. Well, you know, if we're doing a review and the software is already written and what you really want is for us just to check a box, dot an I and cross a T, then that's not security. That's bull crap. That's what that is. Right. So I think this is the way that I try to explain it to people, ahead of time, is that security is not things that we do. Security is the way that we do things.
Nice.
And that's subtle. And there are things that you do, but what it's not is it's not a set of boxes that you check, as sort of gateways along your project plan. But rather it is an underlying philosophy and way of doing things that should inform and should affect the way that you do business. And everybody at any company in some way, shape, or form, even if it feels very subtle or minimum, is a security employee. You know, you have these cards that you use that you have to swipe in front of a card reader to unlock a door so you can walk in.
Right.
You know, possession of that card, there's a security responsibility there. Somebody sitting at the front desk answering the phone and needs to be careful about how they answer the phone and what they say or don't say.
Yeah.
Somebody is, not allowing people to follow them through. Some people are designing security systems and tools and it's really clear what their role is. Some people are writing policies and process and procedures and things. But ultimately, the security team is everybody. It's an extended team. And security should facilitate doing business very, very well, strategically speaking. Tactically, it's not always, easy. And so you try to address those tactical, hiccups, if you will. But strategically, there should be a very obvious and clear, view that security is helping the business along. And if it's not, then there's a good indication there that it's time to take a look at things and try to figure out, well, why are we doing things the way that we do them?
Sure.
Wow, that's preaching, isn't it?
Well, you know, you're a believer, man. No two ways about it. And I do think that this sort of service-oriented mentality we have to have, not just in security, but in IT entirely. After all, and you know, here we are in an economic downturn. If you don't know where the money is made, you're vulnerable. Like, you're seriously vulnerable. And I don't find that most IT infrastructures and IT personnel are conscious of the fact that, you know, we don't actually make money for the company. We help the rest of the company be successful in making money. And so if we don't serve them well, we're hooped. We're the first people to go.
And there's a lot of really crappy help desks out there. Well, they're not service desks. They're help desks, right? And we've had a couple of guests on that have talked about that before.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, a lot of the, you know, I mean, I do consulting work now, right? So for the last year and a half, that's what I've done. I've done startup consulting and a lot of IT and security consulting. And a lot of what I do is assessing and evaluating and then helping people improve what they're doing, whether it's in IT or in security. And, you know, the service, like you say, that service oriented approach to things, you know, that I am here to provide a service to my customers and who are my customers and having that well identified and understanding what their needs are and then partnering with them and being their ally. is really the approach that needs to be taken. Because, I mean, it's one company. We're all on the same team. We want to try to make things work, right? And that's the goal. The old school, philosophy of, you know, IT people are, they have their kingdom and don't touch it. It's mine. And the security people who say, no, you can't do anything. You know, that doesn't help the business. At the same time, you know, the business, needs to, be open to, and honestly, if there's a history of negativity on the part of IT or security, then the IT and security management and the executive management have the responsibility for helping the business to recognize the value and prove to them. And you know, ultimately, once you've lost trust, the way that you deal with that is you communicate really, really well.
Yeah.
And you rebuild trust. IT and security communication is the key. It is the key. You know, what's happening? Why is it happening? What is, you know, if I'm the customer who's reading the email announcement that's sent out, I want to know, how does this affect me? What can I do to help? You know, why is this important to the company? And why is it that I have to stop my work, or that my work has to be impacted for the next 2 days in order, you know, what's the big picture impact that this is going to have, you know, 2 weeks and 2 months and 2 years down the road? And so that I can understand why it is that I'm being asked to change the way that I do things, because I have my own goals and my own requirements, and my own things that I have to deliver on. And so just communicating proactively information that says, hey, we need you to help us, and this is why we need you to help, really can change the game from a IT management standpoint.
And definitely showing that, you know, and I feel like as security folks, we sometimes fall into that trap of always coming up with a doom and gloom scenario. All of our credit card numbers will be stolen. Like, if we don't take care of these things, terrible things are going to happen to us.
Well, and terrible things do happen sometimes. I mean, geez, the last place that I worked at, a laptop was stolen that had my private information on it, along with a bunch of others. And, what are you going to do, right? It happens. And so it's not that there's not doom and gloom out there. Well, you know what? There's not doom and gloom out there. Doom and gloom is sort of a paintbrush, right? It's a great big paintbrush that says that everything is bad. And that's not true. The difficult thing for security, and IT security, programs and organizations to balance is it's a balance of, how do I enable the company to get things done really well and still protect the company from itself? Right? Or the people from themselves, or
right,
people from the processes, or what have you. You want to make sure that you don't create any artificial gates that don't need to be there, or that whatever you build, the controls that you put in place are effective, but also enable the business to work. And it's a difficult balancing act, and sometimes it's trial and error.
Sure.
You know, the way that you have to put it together. But ultimately, you do have to protect, the company from itself.
Yeah, and you are the one that's going to catch it when that fails.
That's true. And one of the tough things to explain to people is that, you know what, sometimes we hire people that are not very nice people and not very good people, and we don't know it, and we do background checks, and we do all kinds of, you know, criminal history and employment history type stuff, and we do just to make sure the people that we're hiring are good, honest people. But every now and then you hire somebody, maybe they were honest before, but for some reason something happened in their life and they're not honest now. We still have to protect against, you know, employee theft, for example, or employee data theft.
Yeah, that internal security risk, not just the right external one.
But one of the positive benefits, let's take that as one example. How do we communicate that as something? Because there is a positive side to that, right? If I put controls in place that severely limit, let's not say severely, strictly limit access to information, for example, right? Maybe sensitive information, so that Richard can't get to it, but Greg can. Is that not only does that put protections in place for the data, it also puts protections in place for Richard.
Yeah.
If something happens to that data, Richard doesn't have to worry about being accused or blamed of that.
When I was working with a dev team, first thing I said is, we don't want access to production servers. Don't give it to us, because if anything goes wrong with them, I don't want it to be that we mess with them, because there's just no way for us to get there.
Right.
I'm a big believer in limit my access to the stuff I actually need so that you can eliminate me from the process of figuring out how things went wrong.
Sure. You know, I mean, I my latest business cards that I got, Hugh McLeod does these really great cartoons. He did the Blue Monster cartoon for Microsoft. I don't know if you've seen those.
Yes.
And a whole bunch of others. And gapingvoid.com, that's his website. So
yeah,
I'm giving
I know
him a plug
well.
Right here. And it's great. He does some great stuff. And I have one of his business cards, and it says, "Tech problems don't exist. People problems exist." And that's the cartoon that's on my business card now.
Awesome.
And it's sort of been, and I've always said, you know, there's no such thing as a technology problem. There are only people problems. And I've said that for years and years. And so I had to get that business card. But if you think about it, and if you sort of adopt that philosophy from a management standpoint, I think it's a real valuable way to look at things is that, you know, people have to build technology and how you use the technology and how you implement it is what really, really matters.
Sure.
Technology problems don't solve people problems. It really works the other way around.
Awesome. Great way to close out there, Greg. Thanks so much for talking.
Well, you know, here's to show 200, right?
You bet, buddy.
Work our way through it. So, hey, all I know is it's been a lot of fun so far working with you and really looking forward to the future.
Me too, man. Thanks a lot for being my co-host and making this show work.
Yeah, thanks for being a good friend too.
And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.